Welcome to the Magic Potion Podcast, where a sprinkle and a dash can enhance your class. Listen to learn about tools, techniques, and stories from educators on ways to improve your lessons, create a positive culture, and much more. I'm your host, Kevin Reinemann, and now it's time to make it happen.
Hello and welcome to episode 45, Getting to Know Kathy Schrock. I am pleased and excited to have my special guest on the podcast today, somebody I've looked up to for many, many years, and I'm so excited to have Kathy on. Kathy, could you please let the audience know who you are and what your background in education is, please?
Sure, Kevin, and thank you very much for having me. Well, I'll start at the beginning. I went to Rutgers University for elementary and special ed undergrad, and after student teaching, my advisor said, you'd be really good in educational sales. Didn't know quite what that meant, but it meant that I probably wasn't very good at second grade teaching. So I went to graduate library school at Rutgers, and I became a library media specialist. I got my master's in that. But I've been a librarian in museums, college libraries, education libraries, public libraries, and of course, school libraries. I was a middle school library media specialist in a 4-8 middle school for 12 years, and then became the tech director for two separate districts for the next 10 years. The tech director jobs were both boxes and wires, the bane of my existence, and instructional technology training and support also. I was always interested in technology to support teaching and learning, and was and am a big tech geek. I used the internet before the web was there, and once the web showed up, I learned HTML and created Kathy Schrock's Guide for Educators, which was categorized links for teachers of education sites. In 1995, I did that. It's kind of like Yahoo, just for teachers. The NEA heard about it, and I wound up in their then newspaper publication, and the rest is history. I then was sponsored by Discovery Education starting in 1999, but I always made sure that I was in charge of all of the content on the guide.
That's awesome. I didn't realize it went back so far.
You said years and years, so there
you go. I did say years and years. Oh, I won't mention where I was in 95 or 99.
I don't. Yeah, you're probably in the womb.
No, not quite. I will tell you that I was on the internet back in, I want to say as early, definitely 93 when we moved houses. And then I want to say in probably a couple of years before that at our previous house, you know, I was one of those, my dad was the techie guy as a hobby. So we were the first ones with two telephone lines in the house. So you didn't have to hang up the phone to get on the internet.
And we didn't have, until 1995, where I live, we didn't have dial-up access to the internet.
What?
Yeah, because Cape Cod, hardly any people lived here then. And so it wasn't advantageous for anybody to set up a system or become an internet provider. Yeah. And AOL was a toll call, so you certainly couldn't use that.
So I may well have been on the internet before Kathy.
Well,
at home at least.
Well,
at home.
Yeah, I don't know because our state in 95 gave us this weird system that was text-based and, a guy at another high school and I figured out how to chat. We would split this text screen and chat with each other. No one else knew how to do it, so we had a grand old time.
Wow. Oh, you were texting before there was texting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really.
So as you're checking out new technology tools, like when I've come across your presentations at conferences, you always seem to have the latest and greatest stuff, and you've gone through it and vetted it. Like I will throw something by you and you'd be like, yeah, that's a pretty good one, but you might want to watch out for this. So I wonder, like, what is your process when you are looking at educational technology tools? Like, what are the most important features? What does that process look like for you?
Well, I try to look for things that are free and freemium, not because I think everything should be free. Like, a lot of educators won't use it unless it's free, but and freemium means they have a limited version that's usable. So I try to put up free things for teachers. I do have some information that's iPad and Chromebook specific because those people that have those devices in their schools need stuff that's specific to them. But I usually add things that are usable on all devices. I only have one page on my current site called Online Tools, But every other page, from digital storytelling to virtual reality and everything in between, has links to apps and tools and work by others who do great work also that can help support the teacher with an interest in whatever topic they want. I recently reworked the home page and put items in categories. I just had them in alphabetical order, being a librarian underneath, but I put them into these categories: assessment, creativity, devices, emerging technologies, information and digital literacy, pedagogy, and professional growth. And there are about 45 pages of that type of thing, and then some archive presentations and such on the site.
And I'm hopping on there and checking it out right now.
Wow. I figured it was easier to do it in the categories because some of the titles of my presentations, unless you really were there, you wouldn't even know what it was about. So this way, at least you know if you're looking in that category, you're going to get something on creativity or emerging technologies or whatever.
Oh, when you've got 3D printing in the classroom, making my heart flutter a little
bit. Of course. I have a MakerBot in my basement.
Nice. Oh, geez. Well, that's awesome. I this is one of the questions I go over with my university students that I teach educational technology tools. You've got to create what works for you. And what you want as a teacher is going to be different than what I'm looking for in an ed tech product. So I have them go through and make a rubric, and each week they have to go find a different tool and score it on their own. So I think I should definitely be sharing your page with them, because they have a plethora of tools they can go to and check out then, and then figure out what works for them.
Right. And with my I also teach adjunct higher ed. I have them go find a tool and make a Flipgrid about it and say how they use it and why they like it. Not a new tool, but something they use, but investigate it more in depth and then share it with the rest of us. And that's wide open, so anybody can go to that.
Maybe I should switch to using Flipgrid. Especially during the pandemic time, I found that Flipgrid has been phenomenal with working with college students, especially where I'm at. There's, I believe, 70% of campus is athletes. So them having time to do papers and all that is difficult. Whereas doing a Flipgrid, they can still express the exact same thing they would in a paper, but they can be done in 5 minutes
right,
or so.
Exactly. And it's easier to grade too.
Oh, yeah. It's all stored in one place. And as soon as they do it, it's there. They don't have to go to a third-party website and push submit or anything. So shout out to Flipgrid there. High five.
Yep, exactly.
So my first introduction to you was at FETC. It's been a couple years now. I love conferences. I miss in-person conferences. I miss talking to people and seeing them, but I completely get why we're not going in person. And I'm quite all right with that, because I'd rather do virtual than have to worry about any of the other things that could come from that. How many conferences do you go to a year? What's your favorite part of conferences? What would you suggest to people if they're looking for one?
I usually probably have 10 or 12 conferences that I attend and present at. I don't usually go to conferences if I'm not presenting. But there are times when I do. If it's a local conference or an ed camp or whatever, I'll, you know, drive to that. But the thing that my favorite part is feeling the love for my audience. I love feeling my love for my audience of peeps. They stoke you and make you present so much better. But of course, you don't have that so much now. But I also like hobnobbing with as many educators as I can at the conference and hear their stories. That's what keeps me doing what I do, so I can try and support them. I never would say, oh, yeah, I know everything about everything. I know a lot about some things, but not a lot about everything. And so by talking to teachers, listening to things they want me to think about, want me to help them with, or great, wonderful things that they're doing, I can then, build on that. So that's my favorite part, is the people, you know, the everything else, you know, well, maybe sometimes the food and, you know, seeing all my other ed tech presenters who are our little core group of, you know, our little posse. But that's my favorite part.
And it's never bad to get away from home when it's snowy outside.
No, no, absolutely not. Yeah, for those that don't know, FETC is the Florida Educate. Well, it's a Future of Educational Technology conference, but it's in Orlando.
Yes. It's going virtual this year. It's going to be held at the end of January. It's one that I absolutely love going to. And then my other one, the OETC, Ohio EdTech Conference, that's going to be virtual as well this year. That's going to be mid-February. It's always around Valentine's Day for some reason.
And FETC is free for anybody. So anybody can sign up and go to it this year.
Which is a huge difference because that's usually, I want to say like $400 to $600.
I've never paid for it because I'm always presenting, but yeah. I would imagine that it's not cheap.
Yeah, but what you get there is
crazy.
Ridiculous.
I know. It's crazy
such
good.
An awesome lineup, and it's like jam-packed from start to finish. So I'm looking forward to seeing what their lineup is going to look like for this virtual event. I know they're kind of definitely changing things up in a way, but being back in the classroom now, I'm kind of like, this is nice because if I'm in my planning period, I can hop on and do this PD without having to find a sub, do sub plans, worry about if the kids are treating the sub right while I'm flying away for a couple of days. So after this conference season, it'd be a good time to sit and reflect and see how that went for everything. So you've probably presented at quite a few virtual conferences by now, I would imagine, right?
Yeah.
So
I
one
have.
Of the issues, I don't mind doing it myself, but you kind of lose out, like you were talking about there, feeling the love from the audience. Have you found a way around that? Because I struggle with, I really go off feeding off the environment in the room. It really gets me pumped up when I'm presenting as well too. So that's a little bit of a struggle for me because it feels like I'm talking to myself.
Right. And I, in the past, I actually have, there was one conference where I was talking to three guys eating lunch and they had pumped me out to the audience room, you know, but I couldn't see or hear the audience. I could just see these three people who were eating, paying no attention to me. That was tough too. That wasn't this virtual season. That was a while ago, but yeah, it was not good. I did feel like I was talking to myself. But well, I've attended a few virtual conferences, even ones that I haven't presented. And what I like best is just sitting back, listening, and adding my two cents, which I do everywhere I go anyway, but in the chat area, encouraging others to do the same, you know, asking the people that are chatting to asking them questions. I kind of feel like it's whispering to the whole audience while the presenter presents. So I'm not focused on the presenter. But then after the fact, I go back and I watch the video of the presentation and I get my takeaways because I'm a left brain learner one thing at a time. So if I'm watching the presenter, I'm missing all that good stuff in the chat. So I tend to do the real life stuff, chat, and then watch the presentation later. But as I said, presenting at virtual conferences is tough because when you have big or small audiences in real life, you know, you can hear them laugh and clap or giggle or boo, whatever, but that's all really missed. Then there's the stress that each conference uses a different video conferencing tool, and I sometimes feel uncomfortable with the tool. Everybody does not use Zoom. Everybody does not use, you know, whatever. So every time I have to do a presentation, everything's different. And then you throw in bandwidth concerns and audio problems. Then you throw in the fact that they were working on the electric lines and there were helicopters going over, dropping men on the poles right at the road about a mile from my house and the electricity going on and off. So it's very stressful presenting at virtual conferences. But I almost would like to be able to record each session ahead of time and then be there conversing with those in the chat while the video plays. I think that would be better for me. Then I could get my feedback from them and talk to them about it as it's going on.
Yeah, I guess the only downside to doing it that way, it's almost like a flipped model doing it that way, is that you can't in real time with your face be talking to them and answering their questions, but you can be in that chat answering the questions. It's like there's two Kathys in the room.
Well, there's very, whoa, you know, there's not a lot of questions anyway. And when you get to the sessions where you're like, quote unquote, a keynote or a featured speaker, they don't have their sound on. So they don't ask questions anyway. They all ask them in the chat.
Yeah.
They've done that. They did that with the ISTE one. They did that with, you know, with other big conferences that I've done. So basically, I can't pay, and I don't see the chat with when I'm using Keynote. My whole screen is taken up with Keynote, mm-hmm. so I can't even see the chat till afterwards. So I very rarely get to hear their voices, which is just, I don't know, I think is not great, but it's whatever. It's whatever they want is what they do. But.
Yeah. And you mess it. It's, I can't wait to be back to normal.
Yeah, me too. Although, I mean, presenting is stressful too, but at least if things go wrong, you can, you know, just use your teacher voice and, you know, and not use any slides. Who cares? I mean, I've been in presentations where I've had two fire drills right in the middle. So, you know, we went out, we came back in, they were live streaming it. The people that were home were writing, where'd everybody go? What's happening? Why did Kathy leave the stage? And then we came back in and finished it. So, you know, you just learn to roll with those punches. But the online punches, it's hard to get back from them when your bandwidth is not great.
Yeah, and then trying to make sure you get back to the exact link, and am I locked out? Does somebody need to let
me? Oh, yeah.
Not fun at all. Well, what I love about your sessions, the in-person sessions, is that you always seem to have the entire audience involved in participating, as opposed to those other sessions where it's really just kind of sit and get sage on the stage type thing. Where do you come up with the inspiration for doing? You always have these real good takeaways for teachers with stuff that they can use tomorrow and get them hands-on.
Yeah, so I've attended a lot of sessions in my life because as I used to when I was in the schools, I couldn't get paid or anything for going to a conference, but I'd go and speak, but then I'd go to a zillion sessions and bring it back to my district. So I know that I like to feel engaged even for a little bit. You know, if it's 50 minutes or an hour, you just like, you need that break time, basically. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just like being talked at, right? I feel like, you know, Ferris Bueller or Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, wah, wah. So now that that's being said, I do, if you've ever attended my presentation, give a ton of information in an hour presentation, usually over 100 slides, each one with content on them. But I also include the audience involvement. I only have those people for an hour, and I want to give them as much information as I can. And everything I talk about is easily accessible later on the guide for those that want to learn more about something. So unless you hear it, you're not going to even know that it might be something that you're interested in. Mm-hmm. But in between, I give basically, they can't ask me questions. When you have, you know, 2,000 people in a room, people can't ask you questions, but they can talk to each other. So a lot of times it's, okay, now if you had to do this, or if you've done this, so I put questions on the screen and they talk to each other. I come off the stage, I walk around, I listen, I obviously, because I always do, interrupt. And, but that's really how I get them involved. I try as much as you can. And when you have those big rooms, it's tough.
And that's another one of those virtual things is we can't walk around and talk one-on-one with
people. No, but you can't, you know, if it depends. Like I've been Adobe education leader for years, and we have Adobe Acrobat Live, and we've had breakout rooms forever. And breakout mm-hmm. rooms are awesome because, it depends on the tool, but basically you create these rooms, you can put people in them, and then you can move between them, among them, basically, and talk to the people. They have power in the room to do stuff, and also you can move them from room to room. So if you want to think, pair, share, or you know, expert share, you can move people from room to room just by clicking on their name, and then they talk to the next group of people. So, but it again, it's a learned skill. And if you're learning it on the fly, it's very tough to do it so that the people are happy. So
yeah, you got my brain rolling now because that's one of the struggles I've had with some of my presentations is I would divide them up into small groups and send them out. And I've never played around with breakout rooms.
Oh, yeah, they're awesome. Once you practice with them, just get, you know, five people to practice with, put them all in a room so you get the idea of how you can move them or you can go in and do it because they can go in. You can have one person be the leader, and then they do the same thing that basically you do in a virtual presentation. And then everybody comes out of the room, and they share. So the person in room one shares because they were talking about this. Person in room two shares, mm-hmm. and so on. Yeah, it's hard to do for formal presentations, but you know, for large groups, because sometimes a breakout room is only hold, you know, 20 people. But it is a way to try to do things. You should try it with your grad students, actually. It's the easiest way to try it.
Yeah, those are smaller groups. That'd be pretty much easier to do, I should say.
Yep.
All right, big question for you. Why do we choose to live where it snows so much?
Yeah, well, I live on Cape Cod. I have a condo in Connecticut, so the middle of Connecticut, snow country. Cape Cod, not so much snow, but cold. I love the change of seasons, and Cape Cod in the winter is usually empty and always beautiful. This year, snowbirds aren't going south. People from cities have come to their second homes on Cape Cod, so it's not really very empty. For instance, I went down to Sunset last night. It was 23 degrees with wind chill. The sand was blasting me in the face, but the photos I took were in a perfect light. So those are the kinds. I mean, I live in a town that has a windmill and a lighthouse. You know, I mean, it's, you know, not everybody can say that. My lighthouse is the one that's on the Cape Cod potato chips, matter of fact. Cape Cod National Seashore is, Kennedy gave it to us in 1963. And so there's no building on the water at all. So the one thing that living on Cape Cod and snow is it's hard to travel from Cape Cod for real life conferences. It's at least a 2.5 hour bus ride to the airport. If weather's bad, I have to go, a day early, stay over, things like that. Sometimes I go to Connecticut. It's only 30 minutes to the airport and a smaller airport. So usually when I'm traveling now, I travel out of Bradley and Hartford because it's just easier when I know that I can get out. But yes, snow is snow. I like snow. I couldn't live in a place that was warm all the time, but it would be nice if it was, didn't snow so much. You're right.
Yeah. I was talking to, one of my other interviews here in the last couple of weeks, and they were telling me where they lived averages 250 inches a year.
Oh, gosh. I mean, we had 16 inches last week in Connecticut, and that was crazy. And then last week we had torrential rain. Everything's gone. So that's fine. But I can't imagine having that much snow.
Yeah, I don't know which one I don't mind the snow, especially having a 5-year-old at home. Yep. He really wants to go out and play. It's fun. It's cute and everything. I think it's that really cold rain that is the worst.
Oh, yeah.
It just hurts when it hits you because it's like wanting to turn into ice.
Right. And I have a Jeep, so I'm not worried about getting out. That's, I could do anything with the Rubicon, but it's just, it is. And it's messy and it gets brown and old and disgusting looking after a while, unless it does keep snowing to 200 inches, which I hope it never does. No. But.
Oh, man. So as you are working from home and doing this remote style stuff, I'm sure you've come across quite a few tools. What is your what's your go-to essential tool for remote and hybrid teaching?
Yeah, so, I said I taught graduate courses. I teach them in media for the Wilkes University Discovery Master's Program, and I have done it for years, but it's always been asynchronous. I can choose to have synchronous sessions with the students, but that's just my choice. It's hard. Teachers have, in the old days, would have open house or, sporting events or whatever. So it's mostly asynchronous. But my favorite tools for presenting, and sorry, there's more than one, are my ring light, which I have in one place, or my Loom Cube, which attaches to the top of your laptop. So I can sit anywhere and be nicely lit. So you can have, a nice smooth light or a bright light, whatever you want. It's a nice even light for either of those two things. And my LiPo external monitor. It's a little 11.6-inch monitor that plugs in via USB-C and allows me to move what the audience sees to the second monitor and still see my notes on the other monitor. And of course, my favorite feature is the face smoothing filter in Zoom. Makes everybody look young. Not as young as Snapchat filters, but it is nice. So it's the Ring Light or the Loom Cube, L-U-M-E Cube, and a LiPo, L-E-P-O-W monitor. And it's just skinny and little and just carried around with you.
I keep seeing these external monitors that hook up via USB on Amazon and on different websites. Mm-hmm. And I've been wondering how well they work. So it's great to hear from you that you're actually using one and that you're finding it successful.
Yeah. So the LiPo can hook up via HDMI also. I just do it USB-C, and you can change the brightness. You know, it just becomes a basically second monitor, just like at a conference, the projector becomes a second monitor. So that's, you know, sometimes the audio depends on what system people are using, whether the audio, it's hard sometimes to get the audio to that monitor, but that's with any second monitor, and that work, that's the same thing as in real life. Sometimes the audio is only on the monitor that you're looking at, and it's really hard to move it to the projector or move it to the second monitor. Mm. But ultimately, we do it. Even if you have to use no headphone, you know, no headset at all, you can make it work.
And I am pulling up, as you were talking about this, the Ring Light. It reminded me of an article I was reading on Forbes yesterday, and I just love the title of this article. Forbes Technology Awards 2020, Geeks Step Up When Governments Fail.
There you go.
It goes into the best product of the year was the Ring Light, is what they highlight as being that.
Yeah, and aside, I don't have the Ring Light. I just have a knockoff, but
a Ring Light.
But it's, you know, a 10-inch round light, can hold, if you're a, you know, a social media TikTok person, it can hold your phone for you if you need it to do that. It also has three or four brightnesses and, you know, and different tones. So you can, you know, you can change it up. They come with very sturdy tripods that go down to, so they could sit behind your computer or they could sit on the floor if you're sitting at a desk and you want it in front of you. So, I mean, I paid $30 for mine, and it's perfect. You just have to be careful because it's a glass ring, you know. So
yeah, you don't want to drop that.
No, right. Probably. But the Loom Cube is an interesting thing. It has a, I don't know how many LEDs on it, a lot, and it has a connector, so you can connect it to the back of your computer screen or your laptop. Mine's the back of my iMac, and it sticks up, and it does the same thing. It also can hook to your telephone. It comes with a, also, if you need it for doing that kind of presenting from on the fly.
Yeah, I just pulled it up here. It almost looks like a GoPro almost with the little adapter.
Well, that's not the one. That's not the one. It looks like a, I don't know, like a scoreboard at a
baseball game. I see it here. It's a little panel that just has a whole bunch of little LEDs,
right. And you can change the, and that one's pretty sophisticated. You can change the Kelvins in it, you know, if you can change the light to
whatever. Getting all science-y here.
Yeah, exactly. You can do whatever you need to do. It's great.
Oh, man. Well, we have a new
Me. Yeah, you. Yes. I know. I see. This was in the notes. I'm like, what does this mean?
Okay, so a new feature that I brought back with doing the Magic Potion EDU podcast this year is taking a spin on the Magic Potion wheel. So beforehand, I sent Kathy a list of what the MAGIC acronym stands for: me, motivate, assess, get out there, integrate, stay calm. I took those words and I dropped them into the wheel decide wheel, and I'm going to give it a spin. Whatever word it lands on, I just want your input on what that word means to you, for educators, for yourself, whatever spin you want to go with it there.
Okay.
So are you ready for this?
I guess.
Ooh, you got the white one. Integrate.
Okay, so good. I want to talk to you about integrate too. Not that there's anything wrong with integrate, but integrate is a word to me has always meant, at the beginning we were integrating technology, and I see that you have it integrating other content areas. But integrating to me, and to other people too, that maybe I just convinced them, is that you take something and you put it in. And not necessarily seamless. So, for instance, when teachers were first starting to use technology, they would, you know, pull out something that they did and stick in something else that would replace it, that would substitute for it. Wasn't really anything different, right? So I went to the word infuse, which doesn't change your eye, or embed, but still I like infuse better, because infuse to me means you're looking at it, you're thinking of it, and you're almost changing it up or looking at a higher level so that it's seamless, so that no one even notices that it might be the same as it was before. It's a whole different thing. So that being said, do you understand what I mean by the differences?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I get where you're going with that.
Yeah, there. And luckily there's an eye for it, because if it was only in bed, it would have to be Mad Jack, and that wouldn't be very good. So, all right, so what am I supposed to do with that? What am I supposed to do with my eye?
Okay, what does infuse or integrate mean to you for teachers? You kind of already answered
it. Oh, yeah, I did answer it. Okay, I didn't understand. Yeah, that's fine. I didn't understand what I was supposed to do with it. Yeah, it does. It just means to think about the whole picture. You know, we all, when we're starting, we all just begin with taking things that we know how to do and using them. Basically, as an educator now with technology tools, you do not have to know, personally, I don't believe this, you don't, I do, but you don't have to know how every tool works or how to use every tool. You just have to know what it can do. So that's why I hope that when I'm doing presentations, when I'm talking about tools, I explain what they can do. And then the audience says, oh, well, I really don't want to do that. But, oh, I do want to do that. So I'm going to get onto that tool. So my feeling is there's a couple of ways to do it. There are some tools, like Explain Everything, that is like a Swiss Army knife that can do 100 different things and very well. There are other tools that do things really, really well, and it's a single tool. Mm-hmm. So depending on what you want to do. So you just kind of have to know what the tools can do and then learn the ones that are important to you. Don't, you know, don't look at these 50 best tools for, you know, recording this. Yeah, well, you only need one best tool. So just, you know, find someone who does that thing well and ask them, what do you use? And then just use that. And that person will help you, will support you. I mean, that's what the internet's all about, right? We help people all the time. So anyway, yeah, that's what I think the infusing is. It's just getting something new and actually changing up the unit so that students, basically all I concentrate on now, as much as people want me to concentrate on other things, is students creating a product to showcase that they've learned the content. What that looks and feels like is based on the formative or summative assessment that the teacher creates. So it's a double-edged sword. I have to teach the teachers how to think outside the box more or differently. And then the students, you know, just pick a tool. It can be XKCD, make a comic strip, whatever it is. But you just show me, it's all about the rubric, right? You show me that you've learned the content in whatever way you think is the best way. So long answer, sorry.
No, that's... I want to give you an air hug right now.
Oh, air hug. Oh, man, I haven't had an air hug. Oh, yay. Over the air hug. Right.
Yeah, that's like one of my big things is that we need to move from consumption to creation. That's been, you know, kind of a buzzword for the past 5-10 years or whatever.
It should still be a buzzword. I know.
Right. It should just be a thing. Yep. And it's... Don't let kids find themselves. And some kids are going to be great with drawing pen on paper.
Right.
I'm terrible with it myself. But if they can draw something that demonstrates what they have learned in your class and they can explain why they did what they did, why can't you accept that over having them type a, you know, 5-page book report or something like that?
I learned this a really long time ago. There was an eighth grader who didn't pass eighth grade because of social studies. And he had to come back the next year. He just really did not want to do that. So he went to summer school, and it was the same. He had the history teacher he was going to have again. And that teacher was one of those, you know, those great teachers that stands on chairs and desks and, you know, dresses up and, you know, the people that are really into their history and social studies and engage the students in every which way and the ones you remember a lot. And so when that student, when they finish the units, the student asks, can I just draw a comic strip? I do all this, you know, comic drawing. Can I just do that? And he said, sure. I'd never heard a teacher say that ever at that point. And he did. And it was a lot of comic strips on different areas, answering the questions that he was given on what would look like a formal test. And, you know, he passed. So once I saw that, I'm like, oh, wow. This is pre-technology. I'm like, wow, what a good idea. So not that a kid can do that, you know, on a standardized test, but they don't really sometimes ask you to draw, but not often. So, but at that point in time, that was what that student needed. And he knew the content. He just couldn't express it in the regular way. So that was
great. We're not all cut from the same cookie cutter.
No, we are not. Thank goodness.
Make life boring.
Right.
Oh man. Yeah. That's a few years ago when I was not in a classroom, I had a very similar situation where I went in and worked with a class that was eighth grade history, oddly enough. And they were studying the American Revolution. And I worked with a teacher and I'm like, hey, I learned about this new tool. It's called CoSpaces. Can we do something in your class with it? This is what it does, makes virtual reality, so on and so forth. And I collaborated with that teacher. She taught the content. And then I came in and I taught the tool. And in 15 minutes, I had the kids up and running because they just seem to get it these days.
Yep.
And there's one student particular in the class that if she had to do a regular multiple choice fill in the blank style test or writing a paper, she may get like a high C or a low B, something like that. And since we let her have this creative outlet, she just blossomed. She ran with it. She was fully engaged in the material and just went to town building this battle scene from the American Revolution.
That's awesome.
And the next week I come in, I'm like, okay, we're going to show everyone our battle scenes and you're going to explain it. And her hand went up right away, volunteering to be the first one. And I grilled her. I was going, why would you make the background snowy? She's like, well, it was New York in January.
There you go.
That's not something you get from a book. Like, they might say that, but that's not something that's going to stick in your mind. But her vision brought that in.
Yep.
And that brings a whole different aspect to the battle of it being cold and snowy and everything there. So, that was one of the big turning points for me of this is why we need to have the students creating, especially with the tools we have available around us right now.
Right. And in between my pre-technology and CoSpaces, of course, was all those teachers that did Minecraft for Education and the things that the students created in those. Although it sucked the bandwidth totally out of every school, it was amazing the kind of curriculum support, you know, units, the way they developed the assessments that students could use some tool that they loved to create something that showed that they learned the content. So, yeah. I mean, and there'll be more of those kinds of tools as things, you know, move ahead. But it's so exciting. Everything about it is exciting.
And if I remember right, yeah, that same student loved it so much that she went over, we were heading into Christmas break at the time. And for her 2 weeks off during Christmas, she built the school.
Yeah, see, that's so cool. Right, exactly.
Nobody asked her to do it. It was just she really liked it. And boom, there she goes. And she went and did that. And, you know, come to think about that, with all of this remote and hybrid stuff being at a private school, we could do a virtual reality open house if we had students completely build all the rooms. I'm going to mark that one down.
Yep. All right, kids, you better write it down before it goes out the other ear.
So awesome. Now let's get into kind of the questions I like to ask everyone. And since you work with pre-service teachers.
Yeah, I don't work with pre-service teachers, but I work with in-service teachers because they're all getting their graduate degree.
You're in graduate level. All right. So
that's okay.
Let's say you're traveling back in time to Kathy before she gets into a school setting. Or if you're talking to somebody that is going to be a first year teacher in August of 2021, hopefully face to face, what advice do you have for them?
Well, I can only really speak to the technology parts of things. I mean, I could, you know, because obviously I wasn't a great teacher apparently for classroom based on my advisor, but
well, just that one person.
I know exactly.
I know you're a fantastic teacher.
I am a good teacher, but whatever. I think I am anyway. So, but my feeling is future teachers, my advice for future teachers is to learn how to use technology to support teaching and learning. They all know how to use technology because they've had technology for a long time, but more often now in undergraduate, just teach them how to use technology to support teaching and learning, right? And pay attention when you're taught about formative and summative assessment. So this is before you get done with your undergraduate education or whatever, before you become the teacher. And don't buy units from online curriculum sites. You are much more creative than those teachers. I don't care, whoever they are. I hope nobody like that sponsors you, but I just am not a fan at all of those online, buy curriculum online. I just don't like it. And especially when I see my stuff there for sale. So I get really angry then, but I've had them taken down. But anyway, just be creative. Think of ways that you learn best and teach that way. That's all. That's all I can tell them.
Yeah. And if you're forced to use one of those, don't be afraid to put your own spin on it.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, as long as, you know, technology, one thing that people can do now is edit the heck out of anything.
Oh, yeah.
Everything's specific. You can't buy a unit on the American Revolution to use in your sixth grade social studies class because it doesn't go with your book. It's not the way you teach it. Some of the information is incorrect. Some of the information is way over the heads of the kids. So teachers can develop units better for the audience that they have in front of them, I believe. Oh, yeah. So
for sure. And like I use code.org stuff for computer science.
Yep.
And every time it's, yes, I'm using your slideshows to make sure I cover things, but then we're digging in deeper with personal experiences.
Oh, no, I'm only talking about, when I say online curriculum sites, I'm only talking about one.
Oh, one. Okay. I think I know which one you're going with.
Yeah, which I won't mention, but it's three acronym title.
Yes.
That's the only one. Don't buy
the one
from.
The one I would prefer that was sharing rather than
Absolutely. Right, but still, most of the stuff is the lowest level of assessment, and that's the problem. It's drill and kill, and that's the part that incenses me. So enough on that.
Okay. So let's take the flip side of that.
Yep.
What about for teachers that are heading into their final semester before retirement? How do we make sure they don't just hit the cruise control on their Tesla on the way out the door?
Okay, so first of all, leave your paper and digital files for your newbie. All right, leave everything for them. You can take copies of it. But if you still have paper that you printed on the Mimeo machine, leave it there. All right. Leave your stuff for the newbie. You don't need it at your house. Digital ones, usually they're going to clean your computer. So put it on, burn it off, put it on the server, do whatever you need to do so that the newbie has a place to start. Next, have a bonfire with your certification notebooks. You don't need them anymore. All right. It's always a good thing to do. Stay on Twitter. And if you're not on Twitter, get on Twitter. But most of the time, you are on Twitter. And give your advice freely to those that need help. Don't just lurk. Just do nothing that you can't say anymore because you're not working for a school district. So you can say, well, we tried this in my district and it didn't work. Or we tried this in my district and it was a great success. And here's how we did that. Or, write me here or I'll go to my blog here or whatever. If you have a great passion that you just really don't, you're leaving teaching, which is a passion, but if you have you have something that you really, really love, apply to share by presenting at a local, a regional, or a national conference. No one knows more than seasoned teachers. So just because you have quote unquote retired, you have the knowledge base that everybody needs. So please share it.
You have those years and years and years of experience that cannot be taught in college.
Oh, yeah. let me tell you. If I only used the things that I was taught in college, I wouldn't know anything because that was a long time ago. Right? Yeah. Pre-computers. in the classroom, right? I mean, really, pre-computers anywhere. So, yeah, that would be, yeah, not good. So
yeah, it's definitely, every time I ask that question, I get a different spin on it. So it's, wow. I never think about sharing it with the person coming next. That's powerful. Like, here's all of my stuff. Have at it. If you don't want it, please don't burn it. Give it to somebody else. I guess
right.
You should.
Right. Or if it's, you know, whatever. I mean, if it doesn't fit, you know, and it's a little different now when with the standardized tests and curriculum that is some curriculum that is so rote, right? You have to get through this. You have to get through this. But there's all those other things that teachers have done over the years pre that that can fit in somewhere. So just leave it there. That's all.
Awesome. So new one that I'm also asking everyone because I don't know, I love food. What is your guilty pleasure snack, food, or drink?
So believe it or not, I don't have any food or drink guilty pleasure. I don't, you know, food is food. Don't give me peas. I don't like peas. Other than that, I eat pretty much everything. But my current tech guilty pleasure is Animal Crossing New Horizons on the Nintendo Switch. So for those of you that don't know what that is, it's a hand. I'm not a gamer. The last game I played was Wolfenstein 3D on the IBM PC XT. So I'm not a gamer. All right. I mean, it's been.
That is a classic.
Yeah, the original. Though. Right. I'm talking like the first one. Right. 8-bit technology on a little tiny screen. So, but anyway, so it's a handheld device. Just like Nintendo stuff is, but Animal Crossings is been out a while. I do have a Wii from when my son was younger, and it was available on that, so I bought it. But it's really hard to use, and I didn't know what to do. But anyway, so on the Switch, it basically you build a world, but everything about it is positive. There's no negative in it at all. There's no like. No shooting, no dying, no anything, no racing cars, nothing. You build an environment. I won't go into it in detail, but anyway. So just recently I read an article and they were doing research, you know, how they do pandemic research and, you know, this can reduce stress and that can reduce stress and whatever. Well, guess what? Animal Crossing New Horizons was on the list as one of the things that could reduce stress. Right. So, okay, I'd play it anyway. But it is a really interesting game and very fun to play. I play it 1 hour in the morning. I'm a left-brainer, so 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening. And have you played it, Kevin?
I have not, but I have heard of a lot of people that do, and they're glued to it. They're stuck.
Yeah, so, yeah, it is. You need more. You know, it's basically, you know, you have to do things and earn bells money and buy things and get a house, and I guess it is kind of materialistic, but you also have to make sure you talk to your neighbors and help your neighbors and keep the island clean, and so there's all kinds of chores and things you have to do. You don't have to do anything, but you want to do because you want to keep your home area looking nice. So anyway,
and is it multiplayer? Because I believe it's online or single.
So
player,
it's not right? Really, it's not really multiplayer. What happens is you have an island, you have a house. There's people, there's residents on your island, and there's certain buildings that are on every island. You can quote unquote fly to one of your friends' islands if they let you come, and then you can't do anything there except gather stuff. So if you needed to gather, I don't know, coconuts or apples or whatever, you can do that kind of stuff, but you can't change anything on their island. You can't terraform anything, but you can just go see it. So like my son and daughter-in-law each have an island. So I went and visited and, you know, saw how much time my daughter-in-law spent on it. It was beautiful. And my son just regular and just gives you ideas. Cause when you first play, you don't really understand how everything goes. For Christmas, one of my friends got me this Animal Crossing manual, and when I opened it at Christmas, she said, "Oh yeah, that was so funny. What a joke." I'm like, "Oh no, it's really good." She's like, "No." I'm like, "Yeah, it's probably my best Christmas present because I learned a whole bunch." But anyway, yeah, so it's not really multiplayer. And more than one person can come to your island if you let them. Other than that, it's closed off. No one can, it's not like Second Life where, you know, flying unmentionables can come down from the sky. No one can come to your island. So,
and then nobody can destroy what you've built.
No. And you can't. Yeah, right. Exactly. Awesome. You can't. You can go in other people's houses. You can't do anything in their houses. So, yeah.
I might have to check that one out.
And it's a kid. You know, it's a kid's game. I think it's really for kids, but it's perfect for adults. And I know a lot of tech people that are playing it, so that's kind of funny too. So we don't like the word play, but we are playing, I guess. We're working.
Yes. So. Learning about making sure the Wi-Fi works so I can go to my friend's island.
Right. So that's my guilty pleasure. Yeah. So that's it. I don't care about food or drink. That's all right.
Yeah. Oh,
so
man.
You can add that question too, your current tech guilty pleasure.
Yeah, I should. What about, do you have any upcoming conferences or events scheduled?
Yeah, I'm presenting, virtually at NISTE, the New Hampshire Tech Conference, on January 12th for an hour. Adam Bellow, Hall Davidson, Leslie Fisher, and I were presenting the TechShare session at the virtual FETC. yeah, exactly. So the TechShare started out years ago being a place where it was before the regular keynote. And everybody was like there waiting, but no one could get into the keynote room. So they put everybody in this overflow room. And each of us would talk for, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes about funny things and cool technology things. It's been going for a long time. And then they made us a keynote. So we actually were on the stage. And then we had to talk about things that were more educationally based, but we still include the fun stuff also. And if you know any of those people, everybody is a comedian on that crew, and there's a song that it starts off with that Adam creates every year, and it's very much fun. So we're presenting on January 29th. So if you do sign up for the session, you can come to the TechShare for free.
And that is definitely one that I will be signing up for myself.
It's very fun. Yeah, I don't know if you have to sign up for sessions, but whatever. I don't know what their limit is or anything. We haven't gotten that far. We haven't had a practice yet, but. And then I'm presenting virtually at IETA, is the Idaho Tech Conference, in February 3rd and 4th, and at the Caucasia Special Ed District Conference in Illinois on February 12th, and hopefully in person at ISTE in San Antonio, or online, depending on when it is. They have not, usually it's December when they tell you if you've been accepted or not. This year, of course, they had virtual ISTE right at the end of November. So we haven't found out yet if we are presenting. I'll go in any case, but I hope I get accepted. And the South Carolina Ed Tech Conference in October, hopefully again in person in Myrtle Beach. So,
oh, that doesn't sound bad.
Yeah. One of my best friend lives there too. So that's a cool thing.
Even better. All right. Well, is there anything we missed, and how can the audience reach out to you?
Well, you know, I could go on forever because I just like to talk about myself. But the best ways to reach me are on Twitter. So it's at Kathy Schrock, KathSchrock. Email Kathy@KathySchrock.net. Or from the guide now, right? It's not called Kathy Schrock's Guide for Educators. It's called Kathy Schrock's Guide to Everything. That way I can include whatever I want. And that's schrockguide.net. schrockguide.net. So that's where all those 45 pages of stuff are.
Yeah. And I'm looking at it again right now. And wow, I can't wait to dive into that even more. And especially,
it's a time sucker. Yeah.
All you have 3D printing in the classroom right there. Oh, man. Awesome. Well, audience, as always, thank you, Kathy, for being on the show today. And hope you came away with something awesome to use with your classroom. And now it's your time to go out there and make it happen.
Thank you for listening to the Magic Potion Podcast. This podcast was created using Anchor FM. Please subscribe and leave comments with your thoughts and ideas from the classroom. Until next time, get out there and make it happen.